It is Saturday, March 21st, 2015. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Well, hello and welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. And hello, I'm geek translator Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, father, and photographer.
Hello.
Hello. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek.
Hiya.
Hey, Ben. And Greg Merkley, trades geek and our Canadian correspondent here. Woo-hoo! For the first time in person. Hello, Greg.
I feel like I should say good day, eh?
Yeah.
Good
day. And so you did.
I was hoping you would prove your Canada-ness.
And you're leading us off today, Greg, with a story about our hero, Elon Musk.
The great Elon Musk.
What does he say?
He says that in a couple of months, by the summer, the new self-driving car should be here.
Great.
Like now? Self-driving Teslas?
Yeah, self-driving Teslas. He's going to take the Model S, update the software in it, and apparently it's going to have an autopilot mode.
So what does that mean? That it'll be road ready with all of the crazy human drivers out there among? It'll be able
Not
to?
Not quite.
Okay, see, it's good to have the details.
It's going to be highway ready.
Okay.
They've been doing some testing now from San Francisco to Seattle. And just basically cruising north on I-5, back and forth, north and south.
And taking their hands off the wheels, and it seems to work
exactly.
When the road is straight.
Yeah.
Trying to take a nap.
Now let's race the Hyperloop.
That. So exactly. We're not really ready for self-driving cars, but what's the problem at high speeds on a freeway?
Yeah.
You're perfect.
What could go wrong?
It's funny, because that's actually a simpler problem, right? Because
exactly.
you've got it relatively straight, there's a lot of clearance, the road is clear, you know, I mean, it's not damaged normally.
Yeah. Aren't erratic pedestrians crossing the street against red lights.
Or deer or cats or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's actually probably less problems than a small town interaction. Though when it makes a mistake, it'd be pretty severe.
It certainly could.
Of course, it probably would make less mistakes than people would. So everything's good.
Yeah.
And if you can afford a $100,000 vehicle, you're set.
I'll take two.
All right.
No problemo.
I was just $100,000. I was going to get one, but now I don't know.
Yeah, now we have to wait.
Now I got
to
save up.
It's money.
Well, now I saw a headline, so I'm about to engage in potentially blatant rumor mongering here.
Oh, good. That's always fun.
But did anyone else see this also? Can anyone back me up on this? That Elon Musk said that one day human-driven cars will be illegal. It'll be illegal for people to drive.
I would believe
themselves.
He said that. I've heard that before. And it makes sense.
I would also believe he said that, yeah.
Definitely on freeways.
It's certainly a common sci-fi theme.
Yeah, it is, exactly. Yeah.
Humans are very bad.
iRobot has that idea,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Does
it's illegal
it? Okay.
To do. Yeah.
Huh. Well, I guess I'd like to see the self-driving car version of...
Well, I mean, assume that if every vehicle that was on a freeway was computer-controlled and they were all network-controlled, mm-hmm. when someone braked, everyone would brake around them mm-hmm. at the same time.
Right, yeah.
And so, theoretically, you could get distance between vehicles much less. You could use less roadway and still be safe.
Oh, yeah, I can see how that could cause a problem.
Unless some human was there, too, and then you'd have a problem.
Exactly. Throw in one stupid human...
It ruins everything.
Monkey wrench.
It's a seed of madness. So
So wait a minute, because in this job market, pretty much the only job you can get if you look on Craigslist or the classifieds is becoming an Uber driver.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess there is that. Well, actually, Uber and Lyft, the Uber and Lyft CEOs both have very different things to say about this. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So a little while back, the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, announced that self-driving cars were the future. And, of course, all of the Uber drivers were like, what? Like,
yeah.
You're our boss and we work for you and we're not
you're
computers.
Saying, hey, guys, you're going to be irrelevant soon.
Just think how much less it'll cost Uber to just pay for the car and not the driver.
Yeah.
That's true.
Motivation.
Also, yeah, and also Uber is aggressively funding into self-driving cars. So they're not just saying this. They're actually putting a lot of money into it. And, of course, that has Uber drivers wondering, like, okay, what's the future of Uber for me?
It is short term.
Well, you could just pimp your car out.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I suppose
stay at
that.
Home and send it out to work.
So maybe Uber drivers will just provide a vehicle that's self-driving. That's all they do.
Yeah.
So Logan Green, the CEO of Lyft, which is a competitor.
Right. Yeah. What do they say?
He says, no, self-driving cars are not the future. And so I don't know. There are kind of two ways to see this. One is to just take him at face value and say, all right, you know, he's saying, no, humans are always going to be driving cars. We may have self-driving cars, but it's not going to be illegal to drive cars. And Lyft drivers there will always be a place for drivers to taxi other people around, right? So that's one perspective. The other is maybe they're trying to capitalize on Uber investing into self-driving car research and Uber drivers being like, what?
Yeah, like scoop up all of those short-term employees.
Yeah, I mean,
if you could drive for Uber or you could drive for Lyft, and one was like, yeah, humans are going to be irrelevant, and one was like, no, humans, come to me.
Yeah. So we're seeing some competition there.
Yep.
Huh. Well, I mean, I guess that is a discussion. Are self-driving cars going to be designed to adapt to human driving, or are human drivers going to be expected to adapt to computers? It kind of gets into that
I think it's going to have to be the former.
Is the interface serving you, or are you serving the interface question, which we might get into later.
I mean, this is the same discussion when cars started hitting the market and there were horses, right? The same kind of discussion occurred. You know, someday it'll be illegal to have horses on the road. People are like, no, that's insane.
What?
But it kind of is now. I mean, you still have to give a horse that right away, but they can't get on freeways. That's illegal.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be following that story very closely, I'm sure, as it develops.
So for the Lyft users and the Uber users that might get replaced by self-driving cars, there is hope on a new startup that helps people get jobs. And the startup is provided by Y Combinator. Y Combinator is a startup manufacturing place. It's a space that puts new startups and gives them money and funding and all those kind of things. And a new company has been launched called HireMe.com. And the general idea behind it, the co-founder is Robert Hunter, and he used to own a whole bunch of ice cream shops that are known for having a big thing of marble in them. So I won't name the ice cream shop itself, but
had
a big
cold
slab of marble. Oh, I kind of said it. All right. You know, ice cream that's kind of creamy. Anyway. he had this, and the thing that he had the most challenge with was hiring good employees, because it wasn't, a resume doesn't say a lot, you know?
Actually, more and more research shows that resumes are pretty useless. Actually, one of the I don't remember the exact details of the paper, but there has been research that shows that the top thing about a resume that gives you information about whether they'll be a good employee or a bad employee or get hired or not hired is how many typos there are. Not where they went to school, not their previous job history, not their
volunteer
work.
Just their willingness to pay attention to the details.
Mm-hmm. Which incidentally says, if you're working on your resume right now,
Spell check,
and run it by all of your grammary friends.
Yeah,
and buy them dinner, so you're not just taking advantage of people who know stuff.
When you're looking for a job,
he's just looking
friends.
For dinner,
right? But yeah, I mean, so basically, the point you're saying is that the old way of doing it really doesn't work very well.
Yeah, that's what he found, is that he'd look at a resume and it had some spelling errors, and the kid's like, coming out of high school, or is in the high school still, and oh well, they went to band camp. And, like, that's all you know from resume. It just does not tell you if you can scoop ice cream or not, or paddle ice cream. So what he realized was probably the most useful was to get the person in front of you and interview them and actually see what their personality is like. Because for these kind of retail jobs, what you really need is two things. You need location and you need personality, right? You need to be able to come in and show up to work. It's really important. So this tool basically starts with where are you, and then it connects people up. And it also records a introduction video. Now, of course, so this sounds great. It's kind of like a dating thing where you'd find people by the locality and a video and go, yeah, I want to meet them. I want to hire them.
Just remember, on your profile pic, do not put the duck face.
Yes.
Not an appropriate place for duck face or boob shots.
And that is kind of an idea of it, is that if this is the place where you represent yourself for work instead of Facebook, right, or some other place where you're representing who
different
you are in general,
photo.
It's a different perspective, and it does make sense to have a social aspect of this. I question whether it's a good idea, though, to make the major hiring aspects on what the person's personality is, because, of course, if you're comfortable with a certain style of person, that's the person you're going to hire, and therefore you don't get diversity.
That's a problem anyway.
It is a problem.
Huh.
But I thought it was kind of cool. It's called HireMe.com, and it's pretty easy to start up and try. And if you're looking for a realtor job or hiring for a realtor job, that might be a good place to start. I'm sure there's other ways to do this kind of thing, but it's, I think, still simpler than in the tech industry, how we do technical interviews and how that hiring process works, which is very different.
And let's talk about that a little later in the show.
Let's have
a discussion about what it's like to do job interviewing in the tech industry, not because I might be doing that at some point, just for curiosity.
So I'm curious about hiring. Bonnie, your first remedial job, your first job in high school, whatever, was it resume-based? And Ben and Greg and Lyle, all of us, is it resume went in and that's what got you the job?
No, someone I knew.
Someone you knew?
Yeah.
Nepotism? Ben? Wait, we'll skip you for a second. Greg?
Resume.
Resume. So you submitted a resume and they went, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
How old were you at your first job?
Oh, a whole 17.
17 years old, okay. So you didn't have a lot of experience on the resume.
Well, no, but, I don't think you need much to wash dishes.
There you go.
There we go.
Yeah, probably
what about you?
My first job was I worked as I cleaned floors. I had the job for about 2 weeks and was fired. I know, it was completely nepotism.
Well, one fired from the nepotism job.
The only job I've been fired from. Yeah, it's pretty bad. The love only goes so far.
Yeah.
One of my first jobs was actually you hired me, Lyle.
That's right.
At the university.
Oh, and it was nepotism. Cruz. Who was that?
We just happened to be in the same room and we were talking about audio adapters and geeking out.
And
you interrupted me.
Yeah,
in
I always do.
And you
said, now.
Thank you.
To this very day.
And you said, hey, do you want a job? And so I worked as the technical assistant and sorted audio cables
now,
for a little while.
To be clear, we were talking about audio connectors, the iPhone jack, and I said something about it. And you said,
you said eighth-inch.
Eighth-inch. And you said, actually, 3.5 millimeter. 35
it's 3.5 millimeter. Yeah.
And then I said, oh, yeah, do you know what TRS is? And you're like, yeah, tip wrong sleeve. I'm like, okay, you're hired.
So he exhibited some qualifications.
That's how I got on the show, too.
That's right.
A couple months later, we were geeking out again, and you interrupted me and said, hey, do you want to be on the radio?
There's a theme here, Bonnie. I don't know if you noticed.
Some things don't change.
Well, hey, I don't know. Both of those were good news. Fun good news.
All right. Well, so more about job interviewing later on in the show. Right now, let's talk about thankless retail environments.
I just have to complain about this article. It's not a very long story, but the headline is Target is to pay $10 million in proposed settlement for a 2013 data breach. Do you guys remember the Target data breach?
Wait, $10 million total?
Okay, slow down. The Target data breach was... Okay, right.
That's
Target,
like all those cards
all the data
were...
got corrupt, or people's data got lost. Or
so
shared.
Many people. How many people?
Do you guys know how many people? 110 million people were affected by
this data loss.
Target.
Yeah.
Data breach.
And clearly they were
and
at fault to some degree, right?
Wait, sorry. What were you saying?
Well, they were at fault. Target was at fault basically because they kind of knew this problem emerged and they didn't handle it for a long period of time.
Before,
so it got worse and worse and worse and lots of people's data got shared. So they lost their settlement or they had to settle out of court.
Well, there's a proposed settlement. And Bonnie,
okay, proposed
it's
settlement.
$10 million for 110 million people. That's
hey, Bonnie, can I have your driver's license, please, and your social security number? Here's a dime.
Hey, thanks.
What a deal.
A dime and a penny.
And a
11
penny.
11 cents. That's two coins.
If you round to the nearest
Or 11 pennies. I mean, that's some weight.
I'd like 11 coins, please.
That's not enough. And Target makes a lot of money.
Well, how is that even a proposed settlement? Has it been rejected out of turn already? Is that an old headline now? I hope.
This was as of March 19th, and I'm not sure of all of the details of this, but
it kind of makes you want to carry cash more, because if you carry cash in a store like that, if you don't get robbed beforehand, they don't know who you are, and it's the money's gone, and they don't know nothing about you. So it seems like a better deal than my value to you is worth a lot, and
you can track my buying data and give my information away. Fine,
for 10 cents.
Neat.
That's ridiculous. They should be charged.
It's so.
You correct me for that again, you pedant. Okay. Yes, 11 cents.
It's upsetting because if security is going to get better, then people need incentives. Yeah. Companies need incentives to make the security better. Target really hasn't lost a ton of brand recognition or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And $10 million is trivial. That's a tiny drop in the bucket for a company like Target.
It should be $10 per person.
It's if they just gave away 11 cents total, really. I mean, compared to...
Yeah, if it was $1 billion, I'd be much more comfortable with that. Yeah.
There it is, the official Geek Speak line. Target settlement is insufficient.
Yep.
Another fine show on KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project with Robert Polly. This week, Eugene Robinson has been a bodybuilder, bar bouncer, and bare-knuckles brawler. He's also a journalist, playwright, bandleader, and occasional tango dancer. He and host Robert Polly talk about fighting, writing, and rocking. Life as art and art as life on the next 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon on KUSP or at your convenience at the talk section of the station's website, kusp.org. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley.
In person.
In person, no less. all right, and so we were going to talk about payment systems on Facebook. That's a new thing, yeah?
That is a very new thing, yeah. This was March 17th, which was just last Tuesday.
Fresh.
So, I wanted to talk about this because I think a lot of people will overreact. I actually did. So I saw Facebook introduce this payment system, and I thought, oh, okay, great. Another way for Facebook to make money, right? Mm-hmm. So here's what the feature is. The feature is the ability to send money to your friends from your Facebook account. So basically, you give them your either Visa or MasterCard debit card. They don't
Facebook,
do credit cards.
Facebook,
yeah, give Facebook that information. And then when you click the dollar icon thing, then you can figure out who you want to send it to. It'll send the money through Facebook, and the money actually doesn't go through, like, Facebook doesn't actually hold the money.
So it'll
be kind of a bank-to-bank thing. So my first reaction when I first saw the headline was, this makes me uncomfortable. Yeah. Plus, also, do I really want to give my credit card information to Facebook?
Your ATM
now,
information.
It's actually debit card information.
Yeah.
You know,
a little riskier, actually.
A little riskier. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of percentage cut is Facebook taking on every transaction? Are they
zero.
Doing it for free? Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
is it just about getting our information? Is that all?
Oh, yeah, it's just
valuable enough.
Well, so if they have your ATM, then it's really easy to ask you to pay for little things here and there.
Well, yeah, so that could be an incentive. But, I mean, what you just said, Bonnie, do they really need more information? I don't know about that. That was my reaction. My second reaction was like, do I really want to give Facebook more information because I already give them enough information just by being on the site? But my main concern, personally, from giving Facebook information is that they will share it with people or make it publicly
that
available.
That third-party thing.
But
intentionally or accidentally, who knows?
Right. Well, I'm mainly thinking about security risks in terms of someone, you know, getting access to my Facebook account, figuring out my date of birth, and then compromising, you know, this account and that account until they get to whatever they are looking for, which is surprisingly not very hard to do. But giving Facebook my credit card or my debit card number actually doesn't seem like such a big deal to me because Facebook has really good security systems.
Mm-hmm.
The issue isn't so much about technical security with Facebook in general for me. It's about what's the other word I'm looking for? Privacy, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they will keep information I give to them private.
Right.
And I know for a fact that they have every intention of keeping debit cards from being shared with my friends and
of course,
you know, the public.
But your debit card comes with your bank information, right?
That's true.
The routing number is part of the debit card information, so you know what bank is actually connected to you, and therefore that's more information about who you are.
And are they doing cards rather than credit cards because of fees?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, most of these companies do that first. So when Google started Google Pay, which is the service just like this, where you can put in your information, they start with the ATM. Though I do have my credit card hooked up with them. But it does act like an ATM card from a general purpose, the Google Pay card. Mm-hmm. What you do is you take some money and you put it on the card, and then you can use it over a period of time.
Okay.
And they also, I think, still have free transmissions between accounts. And that's a big deal because if you want to transfer money, you and I, Bonnie, want to transfer money for paying for lunch or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If we do it through PayPal, there's a bit of a cut.
Take a portion, yeah.
Yeah.
I work for a nonprofit that uses PayPal to accept credit card payments, and it's kind of a bother having a portion taken away.
Well, you might want to look at Google Pay or Facebook.
Huh. Interesting.
I heard
you say Google Pay.
Yeah. It's not much different, really, when it comes down to it.
I was curious how you guys feel about this. Like, it seems like it would make it much easier to transfer information or to transfer money to a friend, especially if you don't see the person very often or, you know, saw them one-off.
I think it's better than gift cards.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Better than gift cards?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think, Greg?
I'm just trying to figure out how much money my friend in Nigeria really does need.
Your Facebook friend?
You know, exactly. I'm friends with a Nigerian prince, too.
Really?
How about that? Yeah. Bonnie?
I'm just writing my boss about moving to Google Pay.
Oh, my God. You literally are.
Oh, no.
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
That's We're doing
email.
A radio show right
oh,
now.
Oh, right. Okay.
I don't even know if it's possible for businesses to do it. I don't know enough about it.
Well, it's worth looking into.
Okay.
Yep.
Suggest Google Pay.
I'm sorry. Is our radio show interrupting you?
Pay. Okay. Send. All right. So, back to the show.
Well, we were talking earlier. So, can we move off from Facebook paying?
Let's do it.
All right.
Oh, you were talking earlier about, you said something very interesting about tech interviewing and the sad state of that. And
yes.
If a person were, hypothetically speaking, be interested in doing some interviews with tech industries, are they in for?
I wish this was more applicable for you, Bonnie, but it's actually the technical interview thing I want to talk about was the state of hiring software developers in this area.
Specifically software developers.
Yeah, the pattern is pretty interesting. You get enough of an interest to get interviewed normally via phone quickly to find out if you know your variables from your loops. Mm-hmm. And then you go in and spend a long time in a room with other engineers. And the engineers are trying to figure out if you're intelligent enough to be a software engineer. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to prove that by being in a room with a whiteboard and a pen. Mm-hmm. And they ask you things like, please figure out the fastest way to sort this array. And then you quickly try to conjure up your knowledge of sorting algorithms.
So it's like
first,
a test.
First, you have to unforget everything. Because, you know, standing up there with a whiteboard,
it's a really hard thing to do.
It's
different from just hanging out at your console or whatever.
Yeah, it's
very
miserable.
Different than what you actually do as a job, right? When you go in there, you're not going to be programming on a whiteboard. That's crazy.
Right, you're not going to do tap dancing in front of other people.
But that's what we all do when we do interviews. Yeah. We sit in rooms and try to... And the thing is, everybody's trying to kind of figure out your intelligent level by putting you on the spot and asking really complicated, weird questions.
Instead of just looking at what you have programmed, say.
That's a very good conclusion, because the article I'm quoting from, which is that TechCrunch, the terrible technical interview, talks about why not just look at what they've already done and use that as the basis.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a more accurate measure.
The problem, of course, with that is what if you're a college kid and you haven't done any development? Or what if you've worked for 20 years for Microsoft and everything you've done has been private the entire time and you can't show any of it?
Those are good points.
There are problems with that.
Yeah.
But if you don't rely, if you know the tech interview process is horrible, which it is, and you don't really get any valid data, you basically have to kind of use that kind of to make sure they don't totally mess up. But you're basically using recommendations. And if you're using recommendations, then you're basically hiring people that are a lot like people you know in your social network.
But, I mean, it's sort of widely – I will say this, that in this terrible economy, I have seen you geeks travel easily from job to job because you know each other and can, like, you know, hey, come on in.
And we happen to be
the
white
water's
males.
The fine. You're the right color, you're the right gender, and you know each other already.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing everybody else struggling to get employed and stay employed.
There are a lot of different companies trying to tackle this problem with products. Like, one of them is Interviewing IO. The idea is to remove resumes, remove face-to-face interactions, so any discrimination that can happen with that, and just try to have a direct connection to screen candidates based on what they actually can do.
Yeah.
So,
Greg, have you done engineering? Are you a software engineer?
No. Just a technical, hands-on kind of
every thing. Kind of thing. Yeah, you do amazing stuff. I've been following you for years, watching what you do and create. So you haven't had to go through this horrible hiring process as a software engineer. Ben, last time you did a software engineering process, I was very aware of it because you were trying to get a job at Netflix. Though you weren't working in my group, I knew the people that are going to be interviewing you.
Yeah.
So what was the process like? Was it fun?
Yes.
Don't prompt him, Lyle.
Yes, except when I didn't know the answer to questions. So being put on the spot, I'm a little more comfortable with it because I've been doing a radio show for 7 years, and I teach in front of people. I teach classes.
And you're good at being interrupted. Sorry, go ahead.
Thanks very much. I was actually in a pause there, so.
I know how to jump in, buddy.
That was a failure to interrupt. It is very difficult to think and speak intelligently when you're put on the spot, especially when you know that the stakes are high.
Yeah.
Like, I know that, so I'm on the radio right now. I know if I say something wrong, then we'll just move on. Everyone will forget what I said and, hopefully.
But an interview, you just won't get hired. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you could just be, it could be made or broken, Like, you forget about what CORS is, or you forget about, some detail of how something works.
And that was my experience doing, like, even oral exams in college. Yeah. I'd been studying Spanish since junior high, And here I was doing my Spanish oral exam, and I forgot how to use the words.
Right.
Just like super
and
basic.
And the thing that's so interesting is that you, like let's say most people on their oral exams kind of forget some of the stuff they already know really well because of the nervous aspect.
Yeah.
Some people do fine. And because they just are good with speaking in front of groups, so they have no problem. But the truth is that studying, testing your knowledge in a language or testing your in a computer language, right, Ben, under pressure is not the actual thing you want to test.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to test how they do when they're fluid and nice and comfortable. Not an interview at all.
As an employer, you don't want to filter people based on how they work under pressure, because in a software development job, as an example, you're very rarely going to be under that kind of pressure. Maybe you'll be in a time crunch.
Yeah, time crunch.
But you're not going to be in front of people live coding in an environment you never code in on
That's
a whiteboard, you know?
So the we know that these things don't work. They keep on happening in the tech industry. Google has put out papers how the trick interview questions don't work. One of the ones, example I've used in an interview when hiring somebody at Netflix, is please give me the data structure of a Rubik's Cube, like lay out a Rubik's Cube's data structure. Now, I heard about this problem a long time before I was interviewed at Netflix, and I knew that it might come up, and it kind of got me interested in Rubik's Cube, and so I started learning the Rubik's Cube, and by the time I got hired at Netflix, I actually knew how Rubik's Cube, like I can solve one now.
So you were at an advantage.
I was at an advantage to some degree, but no, after I learned the Rubik's Cube, after over a few months, learned how to do it, and now I can do the Rubik's Cube when I memorize my formulas. Even then, that question still, I never got asked, but that question still is really complicated. Yeah. And I went through a process of interviewing someone where I asked them that because I thought it was kind of fun, and this other engineer and I will kind of watch them struggle. And the only reason...
that was fun.
We didn't hire them. And you know, it wasn't. It was horrible because I'm thinking, oh, wait, this problem I've been thinking about, I've been muting for like a year, and I have a solution that I think might work, but I've never implemented. And if I spoke in front of a group, could I convince people that it would work? Yeah, because that's what I do, is speak in front of people. It has nothing to do with whether it would work or not, or whether my technical idea is good. So I really dislike these technical trick question things.
So when all that's wrong and bad and a problem, is there a suggestion for what to do instead?
I have a good suggestion.
What do you
have? And I think what we need to do is software engineers, when they're in college and when they come out of college, should work on an open source project, should program something themselves and really develop something.
Even if
it's not great, if they produce an open source project and they have a large bit of code and actually functions and they know the problem space, when they come into the interview and and someone starts asking a question, you say, you know what, why don't we talk about the application I've already written? Or before you go into the interview, send it to the people that are interviewing you saying, here's my application, let's talk about this because I can talk about it well, I wrote it myself, and you can ask me anything you'd like about it.
Mm-hmm.
That would give a completely different way of thinking about the interview process. And if we move that direction, everyone would have to have an open source project, which, hey, that's beneficial because then more open source.
Good for college or people who have not established some sort of track record. Good for people who have been working in a proprietary space and aren't allowed to reveal what they've done.
Yeah.
It works pretty well.
Yeah, if you work at Apple, well, your resume will be blank for all of the time you're working at Apple because you're not allowed to share that.
I also think that side projects are a really interesting way to bend the mind.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, doing other things other than your line of work shows an interesting person.
Well, could you flip that around too? And when someone is coming to you, you say, okay, we're going to interview you. Here's this problem.
Yes.
Come back in a week with the interview and show me what you've done.
Yeah, sometimes they do that. Sometimes there's take-home test things where you say, here's an application, make it better, or write more of this application.
Yeah.
Of course, the problem with that is if each of those are unique and you're interviewing at five different companies, you're doing a lot of work for all those companies.
Oh, right.
If you flip
that's
it around
scalable.
And say, this represents me and my coding capabilities, then you're able to speak intelligently about something you've worked on for a while, which I think is probably
makes sense. Right.
It's advantage you, but you know, whereas, I guess, if you're hiring someone, you want to be thinking about what's advantageous to you, too.
That's right.
The thing that excites me most.
I mean, would people be willing to go like, okay, we'll follow your instructions for how we should interview you, you know?
If they do, it's a good place to work.
Ah, then it's a better match.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, regardless, I'm really excited to see all of these various startups trying to tackle these problems and actually use data to manage it and to see where the state of interviewing goes. I think technical interviews with software engineering is kind of the forefront of the interviewing process.
I think that the one other thing I'll just mention, that if you already have a large application that's public and you can share, then people can look at your code and figure out if you're a good person to work with, even without knowing the color of your skin, right? Like, they don't have to know anything about you except for the code itself and make some really good judgments early on, which is always better. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, which is kind of my concern with the whole Facebook-y kind of version of it, of you can look at someone and just automatically say, oh, black guy, don't want to hire him.
Right, yeah.
And
That's the fear of that kind of thing.
Because you never even get to the interview process.
That's right. Yeah. And there's definitely discrimination laws against that. But when you're dealing with these complicated problems and things like hireme.com shows a really great way to hire people and they use videos, discrimination is going to pop its ugly head back in there.
Because we're all
discrimination
humans.
Discrimination is clever enough to use whatever means necessary to discriminate. That's I don't know true. If we can blame it on any particular format.
I've been judged on my spelling before. So there you go. Discriminatory.
Hold on. Now I have a
if your resume is badly spelt, you deserve it.
It's not badly spelt because I had Ben write it for me. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wait a minute.
High five.
All right, now I want to talk about your face. Let's talk about faces.
Wait, who's which?
Everybody's face.
My face?
Yeah, any face that might show up on your driver's license, say.
Oh, the DMV.
Yeah, what's going on with the
DMV? Okay, I thought we were going to skip this one, but let me jump back over to my notes. There's a pretty bad situation going on right now in California. The privacy and security of your driver's license are under threat by a new scheme to massively expand how photo IDs and sharing of the photo ID and analyzing it is shared with law enforcement.
What?
Yes. So over the last few months, an obscure panel, it's actually called the... Oh God! This
is
panel
it a shadowy seems, panel?
I don't know if it's shadowy. It's the it's the Standing Strategic Planning Subcommittee of the California Law Enforcement Telecommunications System.
Oh yeah, I know them.
Yeah, exactly.
I follow them.
That group.
Oh.
So first off, the DMV is very clear in responses to this kind of thing. They say current statutory and regulatory authority have no possible legality of offering up photo IDs for facial recognition for federal agencies.
In other words, it's illegal.
DMV saying it's illegal. No, we're not going to share this data. The data actually is in a very large system in California that have regulatory processes for police officers to get access to it to search it.
Okay, and this data is like
your driver's license photo exists in the DMV system, obviously, if you have a California driver's license.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Department of Motor Vehicles. Greg, sorry. California Department of Motor Vehicles is the DMV.
I have heard of it.
Yeah, I thought you might have. And they have this. And then there's a statewide tool that allows agencies that are investigating crimes and stuff to access it. And the system is called CalPhoto. You have to go through a process.
Okay.
And basically the general process is I'm looking for someone that matches these kind of criteria. You search the criteria, you see photos in that area, and it's a little bit honed. Okay. There is no facial recognition system running on it right now.
All right.
There's a federal group that wants to add the ability to do facial recognitions across the entire federal government. That's federal government's the United States federal government.
Oh, damn.
Greg, we're explaining Canadian.
He's Canada, Canadian. You don't know. The National Law Enforcement Telecommunications System, the federally funded but privately operated system that describes itself, and the marketing line is enough to just curl your toes, the premier interstate justice and public safety network in the nation for the exchange of law enforcement, criminal justice, and public safety-related information. Just makes me kind of kind of market yourself as the one to beat.
So, and it's a private one.
Yeah. So what happened is the DMV said, hey, subcommittee, no, that's illegal. And subcommittee said, yeah, but it'd be so cool. And they went forward.
Oh, God.
They went forward with this. No, the subcommittee is actually made up of police enforcement, right? And when you talk to police officers, it's very clear they have a tough job.
Yeah.
And the perspective of their whole outlook on how to deal with this kind of stuff is from their legal, difficult job, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, it's clouded with getting access to data quick and fast and saving lives and making safety, which is a good place for them to be. But you've got to balance that off of the general population's privacy concerns. And it's hard to do that when the entire committee is made up of police force. So,
and when the police force is, being revealed to be less concerned, I guess, about the individual lives of citizens.
That's right.
As they are about making things convenient and less difficult.
And the truth of the matter is law enforcement's mostly dealing with people that are a little unpleasant to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, they're getting a skewed look at humanity. Oh,
so the notes from this committee... they just have in their minutes. Discussion ensured regarding the value of CalPhoto as an investigative tool, the potential to receive photos from other states, and ability to utilize facial recognition in the field. And basically, they're only talking about the benefits of having access to this data. There's no discussion in the minutes about people's privacy. So if you're curious about this, want to participate in this, and you live in California, Greg, you're out of it. Can't do this. You can go email the EFF has a really cool tool to kind of automatically email your delegate in your area and things.
Thanks, Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yes, I love
Electronic
them.
Fear. FrontierFoundation.org. We'll link to that from geekspeak.org channels live and editing things.
They've got awesome shirts if you donate.
Have you done
especially
that?
I'm a tall, skinny guy, and they have really nice shirts. They fit very nicely.
Those shirts are not for me. I'm not a tall, skinny guy.
All right, anyway. So recognition software possibly in our federal government's driver's license.
So earlier on Geek Speak, we were talking about faces, mere moments ago, in fact. And Ben, you've got an update about face recognition software at Google.
Yes, so this is actually a paper that three Google researchers released. And I just want to briefly talk about facial recognition. It's kind of a neat application of machine learning. And unfortunately, most times you hear about it, it's from a very icky, creepy factor, you know?
Like a minute
TSA
ago.
Or the yeah. you know driver's license things or, yeah. you know, or automatic facial recognition going on constantly. But the technology is really, really neat, and there actually are a lot of really neat applications of it as well that are not as creepy. But so the paper is talking about a particular data set called the Labeled Faces data set. And we've actually talked about this before. Last year, we talked about some Facebook researchers that published a paper, and they said that they got 97% accuracy on that data set. And by data set, I just basically mean a whole bunch of images of faces that are labeled. They have labels associated with them, names or whatnot, and mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. photos pair with which. And then researchers will take these different data sets and try to hone their algorithms so that way they do better on them. And also, that same paper that we covered with Facebook and 97% accuracy says that research shows that humans get 97.5% accuracy. So basically, you know, the machines are almost doing as well as we are at looking at two images and figuring out whether they're the same. In December, some Chinese researchers talked about getting 99% accuracy on the data set, so actually doing better than humans.
Ew.
Now, again,
it just creeps me out automatically.
Things are, well, I mean, you know, self-driving cars are potentially better at driving than humans, so.
Yeah, but they're so cute.
But I mean, we're not, I guess there's a good point, which is we're not evolutionarily predisposed to drive a car, but we are evolutionarily predisposed to recognize faces. So machines are kind of beating us at our own game. So this Google researcher paper thing is not just talking about looking at two photos and figuring out whether they're the same person or a different person. This is actually taking all of the labeled data and assigning automatically the face or the name of the person if given a single photo. So it's a much, much more difficult problem. And they got 86%.
Wow. Wait, are you saying that they could call from just a big group, mass group of photos and go, this is the person that you're looking for?
Yeah, exactly. So they can take a look at the labeled faces data set, any of the images in that data set, and automatically figure out
a new photo.
Figure out the label that is associated with the photo given another photo.
Wow.
You don't tag Facebook. Facebook tags you.
Right. I mean, that's one of the really good uses of this is like when I go on Facebook and it says, hey, is this your dad? I can just press yes or no instead of, you know, previously it would say, who is this? Right. I have no idea. And before that, it would say, where are the humans? Click on the humans and type their names.
It is true that since the beginning of Facebook, it used to be that a photo would come up and you have to click on the people's faces and make boxes. Now boxes always show up because they know the faces. And half the time, or maybe at 98% of the time, I don't know, the name shows up underneath it. That is pretty incredible.
Not 97, but a high percentage of the time, right? So basically, the labeled faces data set is a benchmark, right? It's not necessarily the real world application of this, but it's a benchmark that that people can optimize their algorithms for. So this particular AI system, they're calling it FaceNet, the Google researchers.
Because they want to sound evil.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to use your face?
I don't know. So they basically, they got almost 100% accuracy on the task of figuring out whether two faces are the same, and they got 86% accuracy when trained on a 260 million image data set. I'm actually not sure where they...
Pictures.
Yeah, but it's a lot of pictures.
Was that 87% of that giant database of recognizing a person's face from a new photo or something else about the picture?
You know what? Actually, I shouldn't answer that question because I might be wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, it's kind of a profoundly amazing technical feat.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. If you want to learn more, so the article is up on geekspeak.org. And if you want to learn more about machine learning, I actually do another podcast called Linear Digressions. And we talk about data science and machine learning and statistics and all that stuff. And we have a couple episodes on Fisher faces and eigenfaces, basically different ways of recognizing faces and doing this.
Mm.
Cool.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Have we linked to your podcast on our website?
We have before.
Yeah, we mentioned
it. We can do that again. Is there a permanent spot for it, or is it just in the episode?
It could be added to permanent. Yeah, I'll add it to permanent.
Hey, if you add as a permanent, hey, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back.
You know, Ben.
Nepotism.
Actually, this week.
We don't have as many listeners
as
GeekSpeak.
This week, the technical improvement I did on the GeekSpeak website, because I seem to code this all by my lonesome, was to add SSL. So now you can go to https://geekspeak.org.
Yay.
And after I've...
It's like we're walking the talk.
That's right. And after I've burned that for about a week and a half or so, I will go ahead and redirect. So every time you go there, it goes secure, which is kind of cool.
That makes me happy.
So I did that instead of linking to your podcast. I'm sorry. I care about people's privacy.
You will. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes, I will.
Let's talk about Amazon. What's going on over at Amazon?
Delivery service?
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to speed up their delivery stuff.
Yes. So one of the things that they're doing is they actually launched one-hour delivery service in Baltimore and Miami.
Okay.
So that's what, queuing local people to trot over on their behalf?
Yeah. And it costs $8.
What?
What can you get delivered? A refrigerator?
Probably not.
Is it free
probably
if it doesn't show up in 1 hour? Like pizza?
Yeah. And, that'd be great.
And 2 hours.
How do you do socks?
And 2 hour delivery is free. So I'm not sure if there are restrictions.
2 hours free?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What?
Right?
How are they doing
what
that?
What cities? Let's move.
It's crazy.
So what cities were they in? Miami
Amazon
and Baltimore?
Crazy. Miami and Baltimore.
Wow.
Yeah, and it scares me because I love local businesses. And there's very little incentive to get up off your couch if you can get something delivered to you within an hour. People already do that for pizza.
But aren't they delivering local stuff to you? Or is it from some – there's like Amazon warehouses
everywhere. I'm sure it's not available for everything. You know, like you can't buy a used copy of the introductory computing textbook or something.
Yeah.
Like that's just not going to happen.
Can I have that in an hour, please?
This item is available for 1 hour delivery.
Right. Yeah. I mean – I don't know.
Now,
it does weird me out a little bit. Really does.
Google Express has had this thing shopping Google Express
Google
for
shopping
a while.
Express, yeah.
Yeah, but that's only in the Silicon Valley area, I think. I think it's the city they chose as their hometown, basically.
Yeah.
And people use it. The thing that's creepy about that is that it's free for delivery. So you can buy a bar of soap and have it delivered with you within that day. It's actually not 1 hour. It's like within the day.
Yeah.
How is that something? Why?
Because they're trying it. Because Google has so much money.
It.
Why not? I mean,
but they made you pay $1,500 for Google Glass.
Yeah, but that's because they wanted me to pay for it.
But why wouldn't they? You know what I mean? Like,
probably they wanted a bar
to
entry.
Yeah, the Google Glass thing is really about making sure that only people who are really interested and would do stuff with it would use it.
Okay.
The shopping thing is they're trying out the idea of being real-time delivery anywhere. And people around the office use it, and it's weird. You're like, oh, you have some tape? Yeah, let me get some tape. You order it, and like an hour later, someone shows up with your tape, and it costs $1.50. You're like, this doesn't make sense at all.
That's
weird.
That's
the point. Yeah.
That's really weird.
So basically, Amazon's doing it now too.
Yeah, and they were doing a drone thing before too, right? But then is that happening?
It's getting closer and closer.
Oh, yeah, Greg, tell us more.
As of a couple of weeks ago, when everyone was being told that you're not going to be allowed to fly your drones, et cetera, around town, the FAA has just given Amazon an exemption.
What?
Oh, they got the exemption they wanted.
They're allowed to experiment with delivering to your home by drone.
So that would make the 1 hour thing cheaper, assuming you didn't buy a refrigerator.
That is, if your home happens to be on their outdoor test flight area on private rural land in Washington State.
Well,
that's the only place they got the okay.
Details, details.
right, exactly. So it's a certificate for experimenting, not for
Okay.
Just doing it.
So wait, which area?
So I don't know which private rural land, but in Washington State.
Yeah. Okay, I love the idea that there's some area somewhere all of a sudden, yes, your land, your area has been accepted. Here you go. You're like, I didn't want this.
Plus, of course, the FAA is going to be watching them very closely.
Yes, that's true. But if they're doing a test run of that sort, as long as it doesn't do horribly and crash and burn, literally,
well, then what do they
it'll
do?
Move forward. I mean, it will be a test flight. Then if it succeeds, they'll keep going.
Yeah. They also have to obtain a new certificate every single time they modify their drone.
Oh, okay.
That's crazy.
And they also must supply monthly data to the regulators.
Yep.
And they have to stay below 400 feet in visual meteorological conditions, quote unquote.
Right. It's like 500 feet line of sight, right? And there can't be anyone underneath.
These ones don't have to have line of sight. These things can go away from the driver. Yeah.
And the drone operators have to have a private pilot license.
Yeah.
Like they're,
right.
they're,
that's part of the new FAA.
They're putting Amazon through the paces.
I'm assuming also.
But not
the,
just Amazon, but anyone who wants to do drone stuff, right?
Yeah. But
Amazon got the license to, clearance to do it. So,
So, for me, that's the question is, great, if it goes well and those current restrictions are in place, what are they supposed to do with their drone program?
Well, I mean, presumably if everything goes well, the FAA will reconsider other things that are a little bit less restrictive.
Okay, prove it. Prove it that you're worthy of more relaxed
definitely.
Rules.
I would say it's just a matter of time before we have, you know, copters all over the place.
Oh. Personal drones everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
I'm not looking forward to the constant buzz.
Well, then they'll just be in an increased sales of slingshots.
There you go.
Yeah.
And a new game for teenagers.
So I want to get to the Mars One situation. There's some interesting rumors out there. But first, really quickly, I hear IE is going away. Goodbye, Internet Explorer, right?
Oh, as a web developer, it's so lovely. Goodbye, Internet Explorer.
Yeah, but is it really going?
It's being rebranded.
They were stripping it back to its absolute core and starting again, basically.
Yeah, and they actually did that a while ago.
They already did that. They just kept calling it IE, and everyone kept hating on it.
Right.
So they're just changing the name?
Yeah. That's one way to get rid of IE.
Yeah.
It's EI now.
Exactly.
Explore the internet.
It was Overstock, now it's O.
It's amazing how a rebrand works.
I was thinking Internet Navigator instead of Internet Explorer.
There you go.
Like Netscape Navigator? I got to say that what the group has done at Microsoft to actually rework the browser itself, when I was sitting in W3C meetings with them, that group is like, let's do standards, let's make this awesome, let's move forward. And they've been a big proponent of increasing and improving the HTML5 spec and all the things related to that. So yay Microsoft for doing that. And if you've got to drop a name of a product, there's no way that Internet Explorer 5, which is belovedly hated, has anything like our current versions. No code is shared, so it makes sense to have a new name for it.
Yeah.
But they haven't declared the name yet, have they?
I'm fine with it. It's codenamed Project Spartan.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be half-dressed, just like all those posters of Spartacus.
Delightful. Sorry, okay, Mars One. People are flying to Mars and they're never coming back.
Mars One.
What's going on?
This media hype thing. One-way mission to Mars. Sign up. You can be one of the finalists and then maybe end up going and all this stuff. And the more people look into it, it seems to be more and more of a hoax. And so one of the finalists, this guy Joseph, Dr. Joseph Roche, I think, associate assistant professor at Trinity School of Education in Dublin with a PhD in physics and astrophysics. So this guy knows what he's talking about. He found all these weird things, like they were asking him to pay for this and that little thing. And like, all right, so if this Mars One thing has funding, why are they asking me to pay $50 here and there and all that stuff if I'm one of the finalists? Why did I have to do my own medical exam and figure that out rather than going to a place where they did a medical exam and psychological tests and all that stuff?
Well,
so,
I mean, from one perspective, you're going to send 100 people to Mars and you want to find a group of people to do that. It's probably best to get people that are extremely motivated to spend some money on it, because
that's true.
It is a life commitment.
That's true. They apparently received applications from 200,000 people, except that that was actually 2,700.
Oh.
Oh, really? So
it's more and more seeming like
I've heard that you need good math to go to Mars. So that value didn't work for me.
Well, it's only two orders of magnitude.
Oh, okay.
It's fine.
You won't bounce off the atmosphere of that. You'll probably burn up. It'll be fine.
But why? I mean, I get like Bernie Madoff, whatever, he takes money, it sort of slowly builds up. But this has been a highly publicized. I mean, all eyes are going to be on Mars One if they turn out to
I don't think this will turn into anything. It seems like this is a PR stunt to get money from people, including the finalists. who are asked to donate 75% of their profits if they were offered payment for an interview.
What?
So, hey, here are our finalists. Interview our finalists. Give us the money.
Okay, I'll just be the devil's advocate a little bit more, and that is that it is extremely hard to fund a mission to Mars because it's basically impossible to do that. And therefore, you need as much money as possible. So there you go.
Right.
How many friends a month are you required to sign up?
I just have to bring it back. I trust Elon Musk more than this.
All right.
Okay.
And if you go to Mars, what can you drink?
You can drink Ground Control, the beer from space.
The beer
Does
from
that
space?
Exist?
Is a space beer?
There's a space beer. The yeast has been sent to space, brought back, and brewed.
All right. Well, more about that at our website, geekspeak.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geekspeak, please visit geekspeak.org or email us at geeks@geekspeak.org or contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSPGeeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and Greg Merkley. And thanks to our intern Chandler helping us from a plane. Thank you for being here for our episode of Geek Speak.